the music of Falstaff. To round off this introduction, Scottish Opera's head of music Derek Clark gives a talk on the opera's music.
Falstaff was Verdi's final opera. In a letter to his publisher, he wrote, "I began writing Falstaff purely for my own enjoyment." And this seemingly innocent statement is perhaps the key to understanding the piece. After a lifetime of writing to meet the demands of theatre managers, impresarios, and especially singers, Verdi at last had the chance to write something for himself, and something which, at least to begin with, he could compose without the pressure of meeting a deadline. Some commentators have noted that because of this, Falstaff is completely different from all Verdi's other operas, but this is actually too simplistic a point of view. The opera didn't grow out of a vacuum, but can be seen as a summing up of a lifetime's experience in operatic composition. No matter how different on the surface it seems from Nabucco or La Traviata, or even Otello, the opera which preceded it, Falstaff couldn't have existed without them. We know that Verdi had always wanted to write another comic opera after the failure of Un Giorno di Regno, one of his earliest pieces, but he could never find the right subject or librettist. We can see moments of humour even in such otherwise dark pieces as Un Ballo in Maschera or La Forza del Destino, which demonstrate that Verdi's touch could be light and frivolous when required. So the musical lightness and humour in Falstaff shouldn't really surprise us. But what is surprising is the enormous energy and vitality in the music, which is astonishing for a man of nearly 80. You can hear this from the very opening of the first scene. No overture, just a few bars of orchestral bustle, then straight into the action. What's also evident from this first scene is the conversational element of the music. Gone are the formal numbers of opening chorus, aria, or duet, and so forth. Instead, the opera is divided into six scenes, which are through composed and concentrate on showing the characters interacting with each other. Perhaps this is one reason why, in some ways, Falstaff hasn't enjoyed the same popularity as Rigoletto, Aida, or Il Trovatore. There are no big arias to attract star singers, and performing the opera therefore becomes an exercise in teamwork rather than a vehicle for individual singers to show off. What is required here is a true ensemble cast who are, of course, equal to the vocal demands of Verdi's music, but who can also play off one another as a team in the many ensemble scenes which make up the backbone of the score. In the second scene, we meet the four female members of the cast: Alice Ford, her daughter Nanetta, a neighbour, Meg Page, and their friend Mistress Quickly. The music is light and delicate, almost recalling Mendelssohn, but the singers really need to be on the ball, as their conversation is exchanged in music which never lets up. And they also need to blend together into an ensemble, even when they all have their own different texts to sing. Nanetta and Fenton provide the love interest in this opera, but their love is definitely a subplot, and neither Verdi nor his librettist, Arrigo Boito, who was also a successful composer in his own right, wanted to give them a conventional love duet. Boito explained in a letter to Verdi, "This love between Fenton and Nanetta must come in frequent bouts, with fresh little phrases and brief, rapid little dialogues. It will be a most lively, merry love, always disturbed and interrupted, and always ready to begin again." Verdi found exactly the right style for these scenes by giving the two characters short phrases which overlap. It's as if they're sharing a tune which they never get to sing the whole of together, and is the musical equivalent of a few snatched moments of bliss. This music also provides a small oasis of calm, music in a slightly slower tempo in what is otherwise a very highly energized scene. In the second of their two scenes together, Verdi uses the same basic music over again, but provides it with completely different, slightly more urgent orchestration, and the vocal phrases are switched so that now Nannetta seems to be encouraging Fenton rather than the other way around. The end of this second scene of the opera shows Verdi at his most daring in a very complicated ensemble where four ladies and four gents are all plotting revenge on Falstaff in two groups, singing different texts and in different time signatures, while over them all, Fenton sings rapturously of his love for Nannetta. You get a distinct impression that Verdi was thoroughly enjoying himself here, and perhaps even getting a little of his own back on his singers by setting them a difficult but not impossible task to accomplish. It's not just in the big ensemble pieces that you can sense Verdi enjoying himself. The whole score is full of ingenious musical touches, all there to add to the characterization and to underpin the events depicted on stage. For instance, in the first scene of the second act, he had fun with the scene between Falstaff and Mistress Quickly, using particularly the lower range of the contralto voice to good effect. You can hear in the music the obsequious curtsy, then her uncertainty as to how she's going to be received by Falstaff, gradually disappearing as she delivers her message that Alice's husband always goes out between 2 and 3 o'clock. Later on, you can even hear Verdi's depicting the gold coins rattling in Ford's bag as, disguised as Master Brooke, he attempts to bribe Falstaff into making love to Alice. Perhaps because he wasn't straitjacketed by the musical demands of formal arias and duets, but was free to compose music that sprang solely from the words of the conversations between the characters, Verdi was able to include all these illustrative gestures and to give free rein to his musical imagination. The seduction scene, which ends with Ford ransacking his own house to find Alice's imaginary lover, and with Falstaff being thrown into the Thames with the dirty washing, provides a natural dramatic climax to the second act, and another opportunity for a large-scale ensemble comprising many different elements, albeit all of them this time in a steady 4-in-a-bar tempo for Verdi to blend together. Verdi and Boito gave much thought to the third act so that it wouldn't feel like an anticlimax after such a big scene. But they needn't have worried, for though the first scene of the final act does provide some respite from the generally fast pace of the action thus far, it also contains much of Verdi's most original and daring music, and sets up the final scene at Herne's Oak, which will involve all the characters and, for the first time in the opera, the full chorus. Throughout this act, Verdi seems to relish every opportunity to use his singers and especially his orchestra in new ways, and the range of vocal and orchestral colour he employs is truly amazing. Almost every page of the score seems to provide something new or unexpected, and again, one is left with the impression that a whole lifetime's experience of composition is being drawn on to make this music. In the first scene of Act Three, for example, you can hear in the orchestra the mulled wine having its warming effect on Falstaff. And there is also that extraordinary trilling passage, which begins with just one flute and grows until the whole orchestra is trilling. It's a truly original soundscape, which would surely have taken both audiences and players by surprise. Even today, the demands made of the orchestra make Falstaff a particularly challenging but immensely rewarding piece to play, and raise interesting questions about the overall orchestral standards in late 19th century Italian opera houses. The difficulties are not just in the fast and loud passages. The delicacy of the orchestral detail in the fairy music, which precedes Nannetta's aria in the final scene, is difficult enough to achieve today, and must have been even more so in 1893. The tormenting of Falstaff provides further opportunities for energetic vocal and orchestral colouring, which Verdi handles, of course, with complete mastery. But he can also turn in a beautifully calm minuet, which could have almost been written by Mozart for the approach of the two wedding couples. And when all the many complications of the plot have been resolved, he produces a final masterstroke, a fully worked out fugue, just, one suspects, because he can. Ending a comic opera with an example of this most academic form, even such an exuberant one, may seem an odd choice. But the text, in our translation, "Life is a burst of laughter, and we must laugh at our sorrow," sums up not only the character of Falstaff, but perhaps also points a lesson that Verdi had learned and wanted to pass on. Boito had suggested to him that after the great tragedy of Otello, there could be no better way to conclude his operatic career than with a huge burst of laughter. And with this opera, and especially with this fugue, that's exactly what Verdi did.
That was Scottish Opera's head of music, Derek Clark, and that concludes this pre-recorded audio introduction to Falstaff. Thank you for listening, and on behalf of Scottish Opera, I hope you enjoy the performance. Visit our website for more information, scottishopera.org.uk.